So today we're going to start the sermon in Luke chapter 5. If you turn to Luke chapter 5, and the material I'm going to give to you today is a material that was passed along in the ministerial training program. I found it to be helpful, to be encouraging, and gives us some insights into some things that are found in the book of Matthew. And hopefully you'll learn some things about that particular book, as well as some of the lessons that Christ passed along in that gospel. And we'll bring in some other scriptures from other gospels as well. But let's go to Luke chapter 5 and look at verse 27. In verse 27, it says, "After these things, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, 'Follow me.'" So Christ says to follow him. A lot of people draw the conclusion that they had never met before, that Levi is just sitting there and all of a sudden has the inspiration to begin following Christ, and that's not true. There was some interaction, some knowledge of Christ, some knowledge about his teaching, and as a result of that, then Levi answered the call and began to serve with Jesus Christ. But it wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing. There was some background there, because if you go earlier in the chapter 5 there in Luke, it talks about the calling of Simon and John and James and Andrew. All of these individuals were called, and they had background in the Scriptures. This was not that they were novices, but Christ knew who they were, and he called them in order to be of service to him. And Levi here is a tax collector. And so he says, "Follow me." And so in verse 28, it says, "So he left all, rose up, and followed them." So he joined with them and began the most exciting and wonderful journey that a person can ever engage in. Verse 29, "Then Levi gave a great feast in his own house, and there were a great number of tax collectors and others who sat down with them." So if a tax collector gives a feast, who's going to come? You would expect other tax collectors, because most people wanted nothing to do with a tax collector. They were at the bottom of society. They were despised, and most people would not attend such a feast. So he invites these people to the feast. And verse 30, it says, "And there scribes and Pharisees complained against his disciples, saying, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?'" You know, they would never consider eating with a tax collector or sinner. They were despised, looked down upon. And yet here is Christ eating with these tax collectors and sinners, and his disciples are eating with them as well. What kind of example are you? So they're very critical. And Jesus was invited. And what did Jesus do? Jesus went to the feast. And as I said, the tax collectors were despised in that society. They were despised because they were seen as consorting with the Romans. The Romans occupied the territory of Judea at the time. And for you to consort with them was basically, you were a sellout. To join with the Romans and help them in their cause. So these individuals had agreed to work for them and help them impose taxes on the people. And most of the people that collected taxes were Romans. But some Jews would bid to bring in the taxes, such as Matthew, and they would get that opportunity, that concession, to be able to collect taxes from the people. And, you know, the fact that he consorted with the Romans was looked down upon, felt this was not a good thing, and they were despised. The Holman Bible Dictionary, in an article entitled "Publican," and tax collectors were known as publicans, it said, "In New Testament times, people bid for the job of chief tax collector and then extracted tax plus a profit from the citizens. And most of the offices were filled by Romans, as I said, but sometimes natives to the land would receive the bids as well. Publicans were held in the lowest esteem because of their excessive profits being placed in the same category as harlots." All you have to do is stop and think about, how do we feel about IRS agents. Most of us don't want them visiting us, do they? And that's the last thing we want to see is audit. You know, we're all sweating it and worried about the audit that's going to take place. So we don't look highly upon tax collectors in our time either. Let's go to verse 30. Verse 30, as I said, they question him about eating with the tax collectors and sinners. And then in verse 31, it says, Jesus answered. So they addressed Jesus. Jesus heard their condemnation. And what did Jesus say? He said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. These people are sick. And I am the great physician, and it is my job, my responsibility to be among them and to serve them if I have opportunity. He says in verse 32, I have not come to call the righteous. And as you think about that, the scribes and the Pharisees considered themselves to be righteous. They did not need Jesus Christ. They were righteous. The tax collectors, they may have been unrighteous, but many times they were at least willing to recognize that they were wrong and that they did need help. He says, I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. I've come to call sinners to repentance. And it's only appropriate that the Son of God, the Savior of all mankind, would be at such a feast. Jesus saw Levi, and some think that he gave him a new name. And the name Matthew means gift of God. He's introduced in Luke as Levi, and then Matthew introduces himself as a man named Matthew in Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. So it's unclear whether Jesus gave him that new name. But if Jesus did give him that new name, that name Matthew, what a wonderful thing that the Savior gave him that name, which means gift of God. He was naming him something that he was to become. I've mentioned that tax collectors were despised, but the tax collectors had one great talent, and that was that they were excellent record keepers. So to be an effective tax collector, you've got to keep everything in order. Even if you're running two sets of books, you've got to be able to keep things in order. So you've got the official books that the Romans are going to look at, and then you've got your books with your skimmings and how much you've made and all of that kind of thing, which you're not going to show to the authorities. So he was probably had two sets of books. This is prior to him becoming a member of the church. But he had to keep track of things, and he was probably a person who was well organized. In a book entitled The Message of Matthew, on page number 23, it says, it is clear from the careful plan of the gospel that he, Matthew, was a highly organized person. His great contribution was to assemble this teaching and put it into some stereotype for in which it could be handed on to others. It's thought that Matthew wrote his gospel in a way that it could be used to teach. Matthew is a great teaching tool. The message of Matthew a little further down says, most of the disciples would have found that a fishing net came more readily to hand than a pen. Because if you look at Simon, you look at John, you look at James, they were all fishermen. That was the work they were used to. But Matthew was an individual who was used to working with books and keeping things organized, and he brought those skills to the writing of the gospel. He was skilled at bookwork, and if we're to believe the United Testimony of the early Christians, he used this gift in the service of the gospel. Paul Menier, in his book, Matthew, the Teacher's Gospel, an interesting title in itself, believed Matthew to be a manual to help church leaders do their work. How do we do our work? How do we teach the truth to the people of God? And Matthew lays that out wonderfully. Again, from the message of Matthew, what we have without a doubt is the most organized account of the life and teaching of Jesus, admirably adapted for the purpose of those who are called to teach the faith. And since our goal as God's people, as a congregation, is to become kings and priests, it seems quite appropriate to review the teachings of Matthew. Now remember, at his resurrection, Jesus appeared to his disciples. Let's go to Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28. He appeared to his disciples, And he said something that is most important for all of us. Let's look at Matthew 28, beginning in verse 16. Matthew 28, verse 16. So, after his death, we're told in verse 10 of Matthew 28, it says, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." So they were to go to Galilee, and Christ would see them there. Verse 16 of Matthew 28, "Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them." So the 11 disciples, you know, Judas Iscariot had killed himself. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, and there Jesus met with them. Verse 17, "When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted." And this is what Matthew wrote down. This is what he observed in his experience with Jesus Christ. Verse 18, "And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, 'All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, of the Son, and into the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world.'" So consider this. Matthew was one of the 11 that was there on this day. He heard these words and he wrote them down for all of us. He recorded the instruction, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you. And what Matthew did is he wrote down in five discourses the things that Christ commanded. He wrote them down in five discourses, and we're not just going to make note of them. We are to, you know, it's not something we know, but we're also to live by them. We are to put them into effect in our lives. And Matthew, as an organized person, put them together in these five discourses. It seems that by the time Matthew penned the words, "teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you," you know, and he wrote that down, he had already gathered and written the things found in the five discourses so that people would know that what he commanded in an organized way, making Jesus' teaching easily available. Michael Green, who is the author of the Message of Matthew, writes, "Why was the gospel so popular? Why was the gospel so popular? Popular it certainly was in the second and third centuries. It was constantly being quoted, whereas Mark was rarely consulted. Today, by way of contrast, it is Mark that enjoys favor and Matthew is generally neglected." And one of the reasons that they go to Mark is because they believe Mark is older. But you have to ask yourself the question, why is Matthew the first book of the Gospels? So why would Matthew have been so popular in the second and third centuries? Why was it so in vogue in the early church? Why was it the first of the four Gospels as the canon or the various books that were felt to be inspired were established? Green goes on to explain that Matthew was often quoted by third church leaders in Antioch in the second century. They would quote Matthew when they were teaching. And Matthew is also a wonderful bridge to the Old Testament. You know, there's that idea that you have the Old Testament and everything just comes to a halt, and then you have the New, and there's a complete disconnect from them. But Matthew tells you clearly that there's a connection between the Old and the New, that there are vital things from the Old that you have to understand in order to understand what is unfolding in the New. So they would quote Matthew when they were teaching the people in the second and third century. Let's go to Matthew chapter 1 and look at verse 21. Let's go to Matthew chapter 1 and look at verse 21. And as you look at that, this book is a very organized book, and you see certain things that are said, and you find that some of these things that are said are repeated. And as you go through the book of Matthew, you may not have seen them or thought about them, but hopefully this will help to bring these things to your recollection. An angel is speaking here. He's speaking to Joseph. In verse 21 it says, "And she will bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Verse 22, so all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. And this is a quote from the book of Isaiah. And what does he tell you? Tell us? He says, so this was all done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. So he's pointing you back to the Old Testament and bringing you forward to the fact this is a fulfillment of what was said in the Old Testament. So Matthew starts like this, and he uses that phraseology. So all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. He uses similar phrasing 14 other times. So look at that phrase and look it up. You'll find it used 14 other times in the book of Matthew. And each time it's pointing you back to the Old Testament and showing you that what is unfolding in the gospel is a fulfillment of what was prophesied in the Old Testament. The other gospel writers link to the Old Testament, of course, but it is Matthew that does it one time after another. He was very diligent to put it across like that. Additionally, another reason Matthew was popular is it was beautifully arranged because it sprang from an orderly mind. When you study that out, it's a very orderly presentation. And it's very concise and it's very clear. The author of the message of Matthew views it as the most complete of the four Gospels. Now, I suspect that there's another reason why they used to quote Matthew and they don't so much today. The reason it is, with the rise of Catholicism, there was less emphasis on following the teachings of Jesus Christ. If you want to follow closely follow the teachings of Christ, you're going to go to the book of Matthew. It is a chief source of what Christ's teachings were and what we need to live by. And if you don't want to follow closely what Christ taught, you're going to avoid the book of Matthew. You can go to other Gospels, and you can pick things that you want or that fit with your idea of what Christ taught and avoid Matthew. All of the Gospels teach in an organized and structured way, but Matthew is the most organized and structured of the four. Bible scholars know that Matthew's Gospel is organized into four discourses that were given by Jesus Christ. We've been through one of those discourses. We took several sermons to get through that particular discourse, so we're not going to go through it again. That first discourse that Christ gave is found in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, those three chapters. Let's go to Matthew chapter 7 and look at verse 28. Matthew 7 and look at verse 28. And you can see in chapter 7, verse 28, that the discourse clearly comes to a close. Matthew 5, verse 28. It says, and so it was, when Jesus had ended these sayings, that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. So all of this teaching in 5, 6, and 7 comes to a close here. And so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings. And the word there for sayings is logos. Logos, which seems to be a most appropriate word for the fact that Jesus was the logos. And the logos has ended his teaching in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 with these sayings, these logos that he's given to the people. And the people were astonished at what he taught. Christ was giving something here, and it seems something is common to us, but the people at that time were astonished at what he was saying. Discourse number 2 begins in Matthew chapter 10. And that's the discourse we're going to be focusing on. It's sometimes broken off and put in the next chapter when one of these discourses comes to an end. And so in Matthew, it doesn't end in Matthew 10, but it ends in Matthew chapter 11, verse 1. Look at what it says there. Matthew chapter 11. So Christ has given all his teaching in Matthew chapter 10, and he brings it all to a close in chapter 11, verse 1. And it says, Now it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that he departed from there to teach and to preach in their cities. So he finished commanding his 12 disciples and he departed from there. So he's bringing his teaching to an end. And he clearly demarks that here in chapter 11, verse 1. And it again says, now he finished commanding his 12, and these were commandments that Christ has given. Chapter 13, verse 53. Chapter 13, verse 53. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these parables that he departed from there. So Matthew chapter 13 recounts seven parables that Christ gave. And then that section comes to a close, and then Jesus goes on and departed from there and continued his ministry. Then let's go to Matthew chapter 18. This is the fourth discourse. Matthew chapter 18. And let's look at chapter 19, verse 1. So he's given everything that is important to give here in chapter 18, and then he brings it to a close in chapter 19, verse 1. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings, again, logos, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea. So Christ has completed the teaching and laid out in this section what he wants them to know, and this is his fourth discourse. The fifth and final discourse that we find in the book of Matthew is found in Matthew 23, 24, and 25. So we have three chapters, just like you have at the beginning, the first discourse, Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. And let's look at chapter 26, verse 1. Chapter 26, verse 1. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings that he said to his disciples. So he finished saying these sayings, these logos that he was giving to his disciples, laying things out for them. And you can see this consistent break between these sections, which indicates to us that they're organized in a particular way. And we can, as we look through the scriptures, we can find five of these discourses that Christ gave. Now let's begin to look at this, the second discourse in Matthew 10. We're not going to begin in Matthew 10, but we're going to begin in Matthew chapter 9 and look at verse 35 because it paves the way for what comes in Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 9, and let's begin in verse 35. In verse 35 it says, Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. So, we're told here that Christ began to teach and teaching and preaching and healing in all the cities and villages. And the fact that he was traveling around and he's doing healings and preaching and teaching, this would draw attention. The NIV Study Bible talks about here, as you look in verse 35, it tells us that he went about all the cities teaching in their synagogues. So he would go into the synagogues in these various cities. And it's interesting what the NIV Study Bible tells us about teaching in the synagogue. It says, A very important religious institution among the Jews of that day, originating during the exile, it provided a place where Jews could study the scriptures and worship God. We remember that the Jews were carried into captivity by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. They no longer had a temple, and so they no longer had temple services. So when they were carried away into captivity to Babylon, the synagogue became a means by which they could go over the scripture. So they continued to want to study the scriptures, and the synagogue provided them the opportunity. And from what we can see of the history of the synagogue, it seems it had its beginning in the time of Ezra. And Ezra probably played an important part in that. A synagogue could be established in any town where there were at least 10 married Jewish men. And it says that Christ began to teach. And what happened was Jesus, like Paul, took advantage of the custom that allowed visiting teachers to participate in the worship service by invitation of the synagogue leader. So he would go to a synagogue, they recognized him as a rabbi, and they would ask if he had any words for the congregation. And Jesus would say, as a matter of fact, I do. And he would speak to them and let them know those things that were on his mind as he was sharing the gospel with the world. He took advantage of the custom. Chapter 9, verse 35, as I said, then Jesus went about all the cities and villages. So as he went to a city or a village and they had a synagogue there, then he would take advantage of being able to speak into that congregation, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Now, before we move on to Matthew chapter 10, I would like to take a look at a few verses that concerning the Messiah that was to come. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 29. And people in Christ's time knew that the Messiah was to come. They were anticipating his coming. And there were certain scriptures that were on their minds that they realized in regard to the Messiah. And so as Christ came to them and Christ went to their villages, spoke in their synagogues and healed, they recollected these scriptures. Matthew chapter 29, verse 18. Matthew 29, verse 18. It says, in that day the deaf shall hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. The humble also shall increase their joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. They knew that the Holy One of Israel was to come, and he was to teach the truth. And the truth was going to be a way for people to be freed from the bondages and difficulties they were facing in their lives. They knew this was to come. And Christ was fulfilling this very prophecy in that time. Let's go a little further on in Isaiah to chapter 35. Isaiah 35, verse 3. And this is not only found here in Isaiah chapter 35, but it's also found in the book of Hebrews. Paul quoted it. But it says here, strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with recompense of God. He will come and save you. He will come and save you. The eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, and the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing, for the water shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. Now, Christ's first coming was the fulfillment of this, not the ultimate fulfillment. We look forward to that with Christ's second coming. But they could see that something dramatic and something wonderful was taking place as Jesus Christ came among them. As in what he taught and in how he dealt with people and how he healed them and all of the wonderful things that he did. And, you know, I would imagine that if you were living in Galilee at that time and Christ was coming to your village and he taught what he taught and he did what he did, it would be just like what Isaiah is describing. And you were there and you experienced it. Now let's go on to chapter 9, verse 35, and look at a couple of points here as Jesus went about. It says that he was preaching the gospel and he was teaching them. And as you look at preaching, the fact that he was preaching, it's more, the word means more than what we note it to be. It means the official word of a herald. Jesus Christ was a herald. He was sent by the Father into this world, and he had a message for mankind. He was a herald. And that message was one that he delivered, and the expectation was they would hear it and they would heed it. Christ came to do the will of his Father and to share these truths with the people of his time. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 9 and look at verse 36. Matthew chapter 9. And look at verse 36. And to me, it's most interesting the condition that he found people in at that time. How did he find them? Matthew 9, verse 36. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered like sheep having no shepherd. You know, as you look at the world in which we live, we have billions of people. Billions of people. And as you look at their condition, you look at the condition of the world, you look at France just a few days ago. You have people that are dedicated to the murder of those people who would defile their religion. They walk up to the door and they kill the two policemen, and then they go in and they kill 10 other people. They feel justified in doing what they did. And then you have the French hunting them down like dogs. And as you think about people, this is how life is. This is how life is. And it's going to be that way, I think, until the coming of Christ. And as you look at people, they go all around, they're going about their business, and they have no clue to God's plan, no clue to His truth. And we find a world that is very similar to what Christ found in his time. They were weary. They were scattered like sheep having no shepherd. Like sheep having no shepherd. The teachers did not care for them or serve them. And this is the first place where a Greek word for shepherd appears in the New Testament. And the word is used 18 times in the New Testament. And 17 of those times is translated shepherd. And it's only translated as pastor one time, and that's found in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. The term shepherd describes how pastors are to lead and govern, as a shepherd leads the sheep. And sheep need to be cared for. They need to be fed. They need to be properly led and protected. And if not, you know, if they're not led, they're not protected, they become agitated and upset. Those of you who were in the church back in 1995 and the months that preceded 1995, did you notice that the flock became agitated? They became confused. They became upset. And the reason was those individuals who were tasked with properly feeding them and caring for them weren't doing that. And the people became upset and confused. So, you know, as you see the church is up, you know, if you have eyes to see, you can see when the flock is upset. You can see when they're not being properly fed and protected. And, you know, it's hard to do that. It's hard to do that. It's hard to know when to intervene, when to take steps. Say, you know what, there's something wrong here that needs to be addressed. You don't want to be too harsh. You don't want to be too easy. And you need wisdom to see what to do. And I know from my own personal experience, it was a little hard to tell. There were times in the church when I saw people passing things out that I knew weren't helpful to them. Tapes and literature and information that weren't good for them. And you're standing there watching it take place. And the question is, when do you intervene? What's the right time? And all you can do is you can sit back and say, you know, God, you're going to have to show me because I don't know exactly what to do. Amazingly, God in His mercy does show you. I had no expectation of somebody calling me about a problem. He calls me up and says, well, did you know this is going on? No, I didn't. I was out washing. I'll always remember the day because I was outside washing my car. So Liz came down, gave me the phone, and told me who it was. And so I called, talked to him, and he said, did you know this is going on? No, I didn't. So then, at that point, I knew, that's it. We gotta do something about this. So at that point, we addressed it. And you know what? The flock was upset. Once we addressed it and those people departed, it was at peace again. But when to do that is uncertain. The religious leaders of that day were not caring for the sheep. They weren't caring for the sheep. And in that context, I'd like to refer back to Moses. God informed Moses that he would not be going into the promised land because he had struck the rock rather than speaking to the rock as God had commanded him. Moses lost his cool. He started yelling at the people, and he did not glorify God. So God said, as punishment for that, you will not go in to the promised land. And let's go back to Numbers chapter 27. So Moses realized, I'm not going in. I'm not going to have that opportunity. But Moses also knew something that was important that he had to go to God about, that he was concerned. He had been the one who had taken care of the congregation for 40 years. You know, he has been with them through all of it, and he wasn't going to be able to go in. But you can see the type of man that Moses was, as you see in verse 15. It says, then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, and the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. I mean, he had been with Israel through all those years, and he had seen these people wandering all over the wilderness and very quickly going in the wrong direction. And he realized that just to unleash them on the promised land was not going to be a good thing. They needed leadership. And so he pleaded with God to give them a leader. He asked God to provide them with a shepherd for Israel. And God already had a plan in mind, and he had been developing Joshua all the way along to lead the people so they didn't get into trouble, so they didn't become weary and scattered, but they would have someone to watch over them, to lead them out and to lead them back in, and to care for them and to point them in the right direction. What Jesus saw in his time is that no one was caring for the children of Israel. The people were looking after themselves. And he addresses this in Ezekiel chapter 34. Let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 34. And I'm going to read this in the NIV, since it tends to make it a little bit more clear. Ezekiel chapter 34. It says, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says, woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not care for the flock. In fact, you're using the flock, misusing the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for the wild animals. And as you think about sheep, sheep basically have no defense. They're an easy prey. I mean, they can run, but they don't have any offensive power. And their only defense is to run. And if you've got wolves or dogs or whatever, they love it when they run. You know, that's why if a dog's after you and you run, they're like, all right, I love this. It's the best. My dog loves it. So if somebody takes off, he's after them. Right or wrong. But anyway, Ezekiel 34, verse 6. He said, my sheep wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. Verse 7, therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered, and has become food for all the wild animals, and because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared for themselves rather than for my flock. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the sheep so that the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. and I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them." I remember hearing these words expounded back in 1995 when things were all unraveling. And you know, this message is to those who are in the ministry. It is your job to care for the flock. It is your job to oversee them, to watch over them, and do what you can to provide for them. In the rest of Ezekiel 34, he describes how he's going to rescue them. And you don't think that God's flock exists at this time? It does. But I think as God looks down at our world, I think he sees people who are weary, people who are scattered. And I think as he looks at the church, he sees the same thing. He sees a flock that is weary. He sees a church that is scattered. He sees a church that has many difficulties at this stage of the game. And I think he's saddened at the condition that he sees the church in. But he's still the God who's watching over that flock. He still is the great shepherd. Going back to Christ, it was also true that the sheep of that day were often blind to the help that Jesus could provide. Here's the great shepherd among them. He's offering to care for them and watch over them and protect them and provide for them. And yet, how did they respond? They didn't see him as the great shepherd. They didn't see that. In my view, as I said, we have a very similar situation today. There are so many people who don't know where to look for guidance, and they are weary. And I think that's the case in the church and out. Let's go on to Matthew chapter 9, verse 37. And I think it's important to look at the responsibility of the shepherd, and then look at what Jesus Christ said. Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9, and let's look at verse 37. Matthew 9, verse 37. So he's gone through all of this about the weary and the scattered, and he says in verse 37, "Then he said to his disciples," and I think he's saying this in light of the way things are there. And I think what he says here is set in light of the condition that the people of Israel, the house of Israel, found themselves in. And I think it's very applicable to our time, what he said in verse 36, and also what he says in response to that. He says, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few." That's our condition today. There is a plentiful harvest, but the laborers are few. And then he says, "Well, what are we going to do about it? What should you do about it?" And look what he says. "Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." He says to pray that the Lord of the harvest would send out laborers to do the work. We need laborers. The world is in this condition that's found in verse 36, and the church is in that condition. And we need laborers in the field. And as you look at the fact that Christ calls himself the Lord of the harvest, that's a most important phrase. It means he's in charge of the harvest, so he determines when to plant the seed. He determines where to plant the seed. He determines who is to plant the seed, how to care for the plants as they mature, when to send his angels in to bring in the harvest. That's what the Lord of the harvest does. He is in charge of the harvest. And the harvest is bringing children into the kingdom. And he's in charge of that. He oversees that. We aren't lords of the harvest. That's not our job. It's Christ's job. And we should be beseeching the Lord of the harvest to provide those who can work in that harvest. So the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers. And I think that's something we should be beseeching God for every day. Every day. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 4 and look at verse 5. 2 Timothy chapter 4. verse 5. Now, this is speaking about another laborer in God's field. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 5. Here Paul is telling Timothy certain things he needs to keep in mind as a servant in the church. He's going to have to carry on in the church. And what does he say in verse 5? But be watchful in all things. Endure afflictions. Do the work of an evangelist. Fulfill your ministry. So he's telling us that in the church, there are going to be other people who have other responsibilities in the church. A translator by the name of Wust says the word evangelist means one who brings good news. Wust goes on to say, Paul does not exhort the local pastor to engage in an itinerant ministry. That means he doesn't say, pastors, be traveling around preaching the gospel. That wasn't their job. That wasn't their job. They weren't to be traveling from place to place holding evangelistic meetings. That work is for those specially gifted men called evangelists, which is also a word mentioned in Ephesians 4:11. But the local pastor should be evangelistic in his message and methods as he addresses the local congregation. He must ever be reaching out for the lost, both in his teaching, preaching, and personal contacts. When we desire to have public proclamation to increase, we are to pray the Lord of the harvest would send out more laborers. Excuse me. When we desire to, so we ask God to provide for us, we ask Him to send those specially chosen by Him to proclaim His gospel message with power. That's His choice. And He has men especially designated for that purpose back in the first century, and He can do that again as He sees fit. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 35, the word send in that verse is seldom translated send. It means more to throw out or shoot out or cast out. To his disciples that he was sending to preach the gospel, Jesus uses a different word. He was going to send them, but he used the word apostello. The apostles were sent out as Christ's personal representatives. It seems to indicate that other workers would be sent out, such as the evangelist Timothy, extra workers to help with the harvest. So with that background, let's go to Matthew chapter 10. Let's go to Matthew chapter 10, verse 1. Matthew chapter 10, verse 1. And I apologize for starting late today. That was my fault. In chapter 10, verse 1, it says, And when he called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. So, as you go earlier on in the book of Matthew, it's interesting what it tells us about Jesus Christ and his ministry. So he's giving them a directive here, and telling them that they have certain responsibilities and certain power. Let's go to Matthew chapter 4 and look at verse 23. And this is where Matthew introduced Christ, Matthew 4, verse 23. It says here, And Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people. So he went out, and he was preaching and he was healing sicknesses. And then verse 24. Then his fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics and paralytics, and he healed them. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee, from Decapolis, which is east of the Jordan, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. So he then gives the apostles this same power, which is what he tells us in Matthew chapter 10, verse 1. He's giving them the very same power that he had as he came as God's representative. So the teaching and the preaching and the healing drew great attention from the public. That's how the attention came. And they demonstrated by their what they did that the Messiah was among them. So after giving the 12 a period of personal training, which included the Sermon on the Mount, he sends them out to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. And he gave those who would become his 12 apostles special authority and power to accomplish the mission he gave them. And it's important that we understand how God uses apostles. He's not like the average minister or elder. I am your average minister or elder. I am not an apostle. But God uses an apostle with power. And if you look at the scene today, you look at the church, I don't see an apostle. I don't see one out there. Would it be nice to have one? I think so. But I don't see one out there. Let's go to, no matter what people tell you, I don't see one out there. Let's go to Acts chapter 5. And look at what God did through these men that he sent out in Matthew chapter 10. Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5, verse 12. Acts chapter 5, verse 12. It says, "And through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people. And they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. Yet none of the rest dared join them, but the people esteemed them highly. And believers were increasingly added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women." This is what was unfolding in the New Testament church. The church was growing by leaps and bounds. God was working through the apostles, and people could see where God was working. Miraculous things were being done, and people rallied to that. "So that they brought the sick out into the streets and laid them on the beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. Also a multitude gathered from the surrounding cities to Jerusalem, bringing sick people and those who were tormented by unclean spirits, and they were all healed." They were carrying on the mission of Jesus Christ. God was obviously working with them. And people could see it. Let's go back to Acts chapter 14. Acts chapter 14, verse 27. Acts chapter 14, verse 27. It says, "Now when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles." This is Paul and Barnabas. They were recounting to the brethren what God had done as they had gone on their travels. And they had noted the miracles that God had done, how God had intervened and opened doors, how God had watched over them and cared for them and provided for them. And they were sharing these things with the people. They were wonderful things that could be shared, that inspired the people, encouraged the people. Let's go to Acts chapter 15, verse 12. Acts chapter 15, verse 12. So this is during the Jerusalem Council, and they're giving the same message to the leaders of the church. It says, "Then all the multitude kept silent, listening to Barnabas and Paul declaring how many miracles and wonders God had worked through them among the Gentiles." These guys aren't making this up. These guys aren't coming up with some story. They're telling the people, this is what happened. This is what we experienced. We saw it. And you know, as you look at people who go through these kinds of things, it's truly amazing how that they see these things and experience them, and you know that as they're talking to you, they're telling you something that's true. Let's go to 2 Corinthians and look at what Paul had to say about God working through him. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 11. Paul here says, I have become a fool in boasting. You have compelled me. You have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended by you, for in nothing was I behind the most eminent apostles, though I am nothing. Truly, the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you with all perseverance in signs and wonders and mighty deeds. Paul says, I came to you. I came to you an apostle of Jesus Christ, and I did signs and I did wonders, not to my glory, but to God's glory. You saw them, you experienced, you know these things to be true. You saw the signs of the apostle. And as I was thinking about this, he said, you saw these things. And it tells you that if there is an apostle among you, there will be signs that make it clear. You'll be able to see them. But you have to also be aware that not all signs are from God. Satan is able to inspire certain signs to be done. That's why you have to test the spirits, and you have to, like the first century church and the Ephesus church, had to determine whether they really were apostles. So not only do you look at the signs, but you also look if they speak to the testimony. Do they speak to the testimony and the law? And if they're just about signs and wonders in themselves, then they're not going to speak to the truth. And as you listen to them and look for the truth, then you can see whether the light is in them or not. God used the apostles with signs and wonders and mighty deeds, and Paul focused the people on what God had done, not what he had done. Mr. Armstrong, as you go, now, I'm going to talk about Mr. Armstrong, and for those who are offended, I'm sorry. Because for most of us, we came from that era. That is our legacy, whether you like it or not. And it's a good legacy. And Herbert Armstrong was not perfect, but he did a great work. Let's go to, as you think about Mr. Armstrong, he did no public healings or signs. But as you look at John the Baptist, he didn't either. He didn't do all these signs and wonders. But God worked no miracles through John the Baptist. He had a different function. As I said, some of the older members of the congregation have probably heard what God did to open various doors in Mr. Armstrong's time. And it's hard to believe in 2016, Mr. Armstrong will have been dead 30 years. And hence, those who have come into the church since 1986 don't know Mr. Armstrong. They may have heard his name, and many younger people don't want to hear it. We don't want to hear about Herbert Armstrong or any of that. But to have that attitude, you're missing out on the legacy of the church. And Mr. Armstrong was a man, and he did something amazing. When if you go back to the beginning of Mr. Armstrong's ministry, as you go back to that period of time, the Church of God was confused. It was in disarray. And Mr. Armstrong came on the scene and he rallied the church. He rallied the church, and the church grew in an amazing way. It grew and grew. He was invited at a time to give a regular religious program. They invited him to do it. And out of that one little invitation, the church grew and grew and eventually led to a great work, 3 AC campuses, invitations to many world leaders. Mr. Bob Fay, while serving in South Africa, saw so many doors opening in that nation that it was astonishing. And this is just the example of South Africa. When he was in South Africa, a man had picked up the plain truth and written to him. And He wrote to Mr. Fay, and he invited him to come down to Cape Town, South Africa, for lunch. And the writer of the letter to Mr. Fay said, you know, Mr. Armstrong needs to come down here and preach the plain truth about South Africa. And the man was the chairman of a South African foundation which tried to promote goodwill between South Africa and other nations. So they didn't search this fellow out. He wrote a letter. And he said, why don't you invite Mr. Armstrong down? So Mr. Fay sent on the message, maybe it would be nice for Mr. Armstrong to visit South Africa. And shortly after Mr. Fay let headquarters know about that, well, they said that Mr. Armstrong was going to come to South Africa. And they called him up and said, what we'd like you to do is to set up a meeting with the Prime Minister, the State President, and various cabinet members and speech clubs. So Mr. Fay said, well, I don't know how to do any of this. You know, if somebody called you and said, I want you to set up a meeting with the governor, how would you do that? You can walk into Governor Abbott's office and say, hey, you know what? We'd like to have a meeting with you. And probably they would escort you right out of the office. That's if you got in the office. So anyway, there, you know, you're just not just going to walk in there and make such an offering. But they said, we want you to do these things. And the minister said, I don't know how to do any of this. Never done it before. The person who called him up said, well, maybe you ought to talk to that man who wrote the original letter. He might be able to help. So the minister contacted the man and said and explained what he was trying to do. And the man said, I can arrange that. I could help set up meetings with the prime minister and the cabinet officials. And I can also set it up where you can meet with the Rotary Club and Roundtable. I have no idea what the Roundtable is. I think of King Arthur every time I hear that, but I don't think it has to do with that. He said, I don't have the Lions Club, but the minister said, but we'll do Rotary and the Roundtable. So they set up public Bible lectures in all the major cities in South Africa, and it ended up that Mr. Armstrong made several trips to South Africa, and it was astonishing that there was nothing, and then it all opened up. There was nothing, and then it all opened up. And as I said, there was no opening for the Lions Club, but the church had offices in Johannesburg. And one day, David Hume, who worked in the office at that time, was riding in an elevator up to the offices. And there was a man in the elevator with him who was all agitated. And Mr. Hume asked him why he was so agitated. And David Hume was told, I've been appointed president of the Lions Club, and a club for the whole of Johannesburg, which was a huge area. And he said, I've decided to have a theme for the whole year. And David hadn't said anything yet. And he was just standing there. And the theme that the person had decided upon was international peace. He said, I'm looking for some kind of speaker to come from overseas and talk to the Lions Club. And David said, perhaps we can help. And the man's name, interestingly, was Jimmy Lamb. So they walked off the elevator on the floor where the church's offices were, and they walked around to the entryway to the church's offices. And there on each door was the symbol of Ambassador College, the lion, the lamb, and the child. And what does Jimmy Lamb say? Look at that, the lion. That's me. I am with the Lions, and my name is Lamb. So he came on into the offices, and everybody was introduced, and they started talking. And a meeting was set up between the church and the presidents of the various Lions clubs around Johannesburg. And Mr. Fay and Mr. Hume went to the meeting, and he had all these presidents of the Lions Club and Mr. Hume and Mr. Fay there. And everybody's talking back and forth about what they're going to do. And Mr. Fay would raise his hand and interject something into the conversation. And he said every time that he did, the idea would seem to kind of deflate and get smaller. And so every time he kept his mouth shut, it seemed like it would all grow and get bigger. And so he, interjected a couple of different times and saw what was happening. And he finally said, my best option here is to keep my mouth shut. So he did. The idea got bigger and bigger. In the end, they decided, with the minister sitting silently, that Mr. Armstrong should address all the Lions Club in that area on one big occasion. Jimmy Lamb was so supportive of this that he said when he was finished with this, he was going to devote his whole life. This is going to be my life's mission, he said. Mr. Armstrong came. He spoke to the Lions Club. He gave his usual address. The audience heard the message. Everybody went home. And what happened to Jimmy Lamb? Jimmy Lamb went on with his life like it never happened. Never did another thing. Went on about his life. As you look back on what took place there, it's very clear that God had gotten the Lions Club together. It was not done by the church. It was not done by Mr. Armstrong. It wasn't done by men. It was God's doing. God opened the doors. And God did these things over and over again, not only in South Africa, but throughout Mr. Armstrong's era. So let's go to Matthew 10, where we're going to conclude. Matthew chapter 10, let's look at verse 2. It says, "Now the names of the 12 apostles are these." And he goes on to name all the 12 apostles. And did you know that this is the only place in Matthew where the 12 are referred to as apostles? The only place in the book of Matthew where they are mentioned. And it's the first time that the word apostle is used in the New Testament. Thayer's definition of apostle is a delegate, a messenger, one sent forth with orders. The message of Matthew defines apostle as sent ones, and it denotes action rather than status. The fact that a person is an apostle does not mean that they hold an office that's superior to you. It means that that person has been sent as a herald to speak to people about the gospel of the kingdom of heaven. That is their job. That was the job of Jesus Christ. That's why he's called an apostle. And these men were apostles. They were to go out and represent God. It's a humble word, somebody who's sent. And as you think of God's words, they are humble. You never see in the scriptures people being addressed as the right reverend so-and-so, do you? That's something of men. That's not of God. Matthew used the word send or sent often, apostello. And appropriately, Matthew uses the term apostle when they were being sent out. An apostle is one personally chosen by Jesus Christ to represent him, to be a witness of his resurrection and proclaim the gospel. As we will see, they are to travel from city to city proclaiming his gospel. And when the apostles are mentioned, the word go is often used. They were sent. They were to go. Let's look at a couple of verses in Acts. Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10. Verse 39. It says, "And we are witnesses of all things which he did, both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem, whom they killed by hanging on a tree." They were witnesses. What they were relaying was their experience. They saw it. They saw the miracles. They ate and slept with Jesus Christ. They experienced it all. And as God opened their minds and gave them commission, they took it seriously. I don't think you could have heard more motivated speakers than the 11 and ultimately the 12 as Matthias was added. Must witness here is the ancestor of the word martyr. A witness is somebody who is willing to lay down their life that they are telling the truth. And as you think about the apostles, they all did, except for the apostle John. Let's go to verse 40. It says, "Him God raised up on the third day and showed him openly, not to all the people, but to the witnesses chosen before by God, even to us, who ate and drank with him, and after he arose from the dead. And he commanded us to preach the gospel, preach to the people, and to testify that it is he who was ordained by God to be judge of the living and the dead." They were to testify. They were witnesses. They were witnesses on God's behalf. Verse 43, "To him all the prophets witness that through his name whoever believes in him will receive remission of sins." And they went out and they preached the gospel. And next time, as we continue through Matthew chapter 10, we'll find that it's been divided into three sections. Not only did Matthew write five discourses, but in Matthew 10, he divided it into three sections. And they're very clearly demarked. And we'll take a look at them next time. So I thought I would begin this study with a little background. And I look forward to continuing through Matthew 10 and breaking it down with you. I hope that you've found this as profitable as I did. Hopefully it will be an inspiration for you. And more than anything, in the times in which we live, I hope you will dedicate yourself to praying to the Lord of the harvest, that he will give us those people to be out in the harvest and to glean what is there.